We need the ACRI, the group relations perspective. The business case for sustainability has been argued many times. I think it peaked in January 2007 when this publication came out, along with, seemed like every other business publication in the U.S. had a cover story about going green and profiting. Okay. So this argument has been made many times, and yet there's still not all that much action. So I think this calls for the group relations perspective, and I hope that I can recruit some people today. So what I want to do is kind of walk you through a framework that I use. I've been working with both environmental professionals and business professionals for the last decade. And I've developed a framework that I use to introduce them to the field. And I'm not claiming that this is the best or the only framework, but it's one that has worked for me. And I think what's important is that there be a framework, some kind of organization of the information blast that we all get every day about green this and green that. Okay, so it's important, and I will provide commentary along the way about what I've learned about how people learn about this stuff and what is impactful and what doesn't work. And one thing I found is that it is important to have the material organized into some kind of framework. So I will walk you through one that I use, and then begin a discussion of applying group relations perspective to this field. So here we go. The basic. Can you not see?
No.
I don't think I want to sit down. Anybody know where the definition of sustainable development came from? No. Okay. The term was coined in 1987 in a UN report, and the essence of it was to de-link economic development from environmental degradation. So the idea was to continue to bring people out of poverty around the world and promote economic development, but to do it not in the way the West has done it, which is to pollute first and then try to clean up later, but to chart a greener path to economic development for people around the world. And what I argue is that this agenda has shifted the landscape for business, and we're in a period of creative destruction where the companies and the organizations who understand the shift and are behaving consistent with that, in alignment with that, have great opportunity. Whereas the companies that don't understand the agenda and behave in ways as if we were before the shifts had taken place are in danger of failing. Okay. I'm going to just go through each of these three shifts very briefly and give some examples. The first shift, and this comes from the book Natural Capitalism, says that we're now in a second industrial revolution. In the first industrial revolution, we were in a situation where natural resources were plentiful, but labor was scarce. So if you think about what kinds of inventions and innovations helped us to make economic progress in that first situation? What do you think?
Railroads,
okay. What else?
Steam engine,
all right.
What was the question?
What kinds of inventions and innovations helped us make progress in the first industrial revolution when resources were plentiful, but labor was scarce?
Electricity.
Labor-saving inventions,
right. Okay, especially in factories like assembly lines and machinery, right? Because it extended the productivity of each scarce laborer. right? So now we're in a the reverse situation, of course. We have plentiful labor. In fact, we have a serious unemployment problem. And natural resources are increasingly scarce. So if you apply the same logic that we used the first time around to this situation, what should we be doing now?
Get rid of all those machines and automated mass production.
Okay. What else?
Maybe doing things more locally and on a less grand scale. Like same kind of industries, but smaller and more local.
Okay. What's the element we're trying to maximize here?
Finding ways to use labor in order to reduce natural resources.
Oh, okay. But in essence, it's using each... I have an example of that coming up. But in essence, it's using each unit of natural resource as efficiently and effectively as possible, right? Getting the most out of each unit of natural resource, just like the assembly lines and machinery enabled us to get the most out of each labor, okay? So
how do we know that there are scarce resources? That's what I can figure out. I mean, no gas stations are closed. And
right.
Somebody has electricity. How do I know that resources are scarce?
The cost, the way that the costs work, it doesn't, exactly.
You know, the pricing doesn't reflect the scarcity necessarily?
Yeah.
Right, okay. It's not a completely, the market doesn't, the invisible hand of the market doesn't always work.
Especially when the government gives them. It doesn't always work, it's just invisible.
Well, so for example, if you're in the fishing business, should you be focused more on the technology of the equipment and the boats so that you can catch more and more fish more quickly? Or should you be focused on the biology of the fish and how to maintain the population sustainably?
Yes.
Right, okay. So you're in the second industrial revolution. You got it. Here's your example. This came from an experience I had leading an executive education program in India with power company executives, and I would come out of... I was in the part of India where it would rain almost every night, and in the morning I'd come out and there was debris from the trees on the ground, on the walkways and the driveways. And there would be more than three, maybe four or five women with these brooms made out of broom grass sweeping up the debris. So here they were using a product that was made from a locally grown source, broom grass. It was completely biodegradable. They were employing four or five people, and they were doing it in a way that was completely quiet and didn't disturb the community. And it came to my mind that the way we would solve this problem in the U.S. would be to hire a single individual, give them a gas-powered blower, leaf blower, that would emit carbon dioxide, make a lot of noise, disturb everyone in the community, and be quite a problem at disposal time when it was at the end of its useful life. Okay. So if you're mindful of being in this second industrial revolution, you have to ask the question of which solution is more advanced. Yeah.
What I'm thinking about, the person who comes and does the leaf removal for where I live,
right.
I mentioned to him how could you not use that leaf blower, and his response is about the availability of the technology is so present, mm-hmm. why should he expend so much physical labor?
Yeah.
And he's wedded to the idea of the leaf blower because
right.
of the implications for his personal life.
Yeah.
So the workers themselves, are mm-hmm. in this picture.
Right, for sure, yeah. Do you think the Indian women would prefer a leaf blower if given the choice?
But I think what Mickey's saying is important, because for industrialized or post whatever we call the developed countries, productivity has been a horse they've ridden for many decades.
Right.
So the idea of convincing them to give up maximum productivity is a very tall order.
Well, yeah, the way we define productivity is is part of the, what I would say is part of the mental map is still, maps are still in the first industrial revolution.
Yes.
The landscape is in the second, and we need to adjust. The maps are no longer accurate. We need to adjust them. Yeah.
You're saying that we, in the older days, would look at output per worker as productivity. This is the one with the leaf blower. Productivity, output per worker?
Yes.
Yeah. And now, over here, we are looking at what? What are we looking at? What would you say? The productivity is output per worker.
Output per resource.
Per unit of natural resource.
Okay.
Yeah.
But we're not natural resources?
Not yeah. Not the way the term is usually used. Yeah.
I'm trying to get my head around.
Yeah. Yeah, okay.
But we're the resource that keeps on growing.
Yes.
Well, you know, there's
the natural resource that keeps growing.
When I look at this one, there's the other, because I was thinking that, you know, if you kind of really expand it and you think about us as resources, people as resources, laborers as resources as well, then, I mean, there certainly has been an attitude, well, we just kind of, that people with very hard and arduous jobs, they just work and work and work, and then they can't work anymore, and they're cast aside, and society takes care of them, and maybe it doesn't. And so, you know, if you kind of, like, look at this, so, like, those three women who are sweeping, I mean, maybe that's really hard work in there, and you know, they're going to be exhausted if, in fact, we can get, you know, three people to go pick up
Let's get.
I think that goes to like how people see work, and I think you're right. It's the worker, but it's also the view of work being a meditative exercise, and work being something that you just do instead of work being something that you do in order to go home and play.
Okay. Well, let's. Let me say that when I show this to a group of MBAs, it's quite provocative. It gets them thinking. It is, that's true. But in a different way, yes. So let's look at another example. This is a kind of simple one. UPS figured out that if they use this software program RoadNet, they could have it design the routes for the trucks without any left turns. And they've calculated that they can save 3 million gallons of fuel per year by eliminating that extra idle time that it takes to make a left turn instead of a right turn. Okay. So here they are trying to use each gallon of gas, make each gallon of gas go as far as possible. Here's another one. Any of you heard of Interface Carpet? I think of them as the poster child for sustainable business. What they did was they figured out their customers were mostly commercial, like offices. So we don't have carpet here, but like office settings. And they figured out that especially in an office setting, that 80% of the wear was on 20% of the carpet, right? Part that people walk on. So instead of making the carpet in those big rolls, they started making it in squares. And so then, if a square got soiled or worn, you could just replace the one square. Okay, it's not rocket science, but it is thinking outside the box. And then they changed their business model as well. They found that The office building owners didn't especially want to own the carpet. They just wanted the use of it. So they started leasing the carpet. That way they could send the carpet inspector around once a month to retrieve replace the worn or soiled squares. And they started doing research on the carpet that they took back, and they found ways to reuse the recycled carpet. And so they have kept billions of pounds of carpet out of landfill. And they have become, so many other companies come to them and say, tell us how you did it, that they now have a consulting business too. So that's another example. And in the another thing that's happening is in Europe it's called consumption without ownership. This is a continuation of this leasing or servicing model, it's sometimes called. And some of these things that you use, these tools or sports equipment that you use infrequently, if you lease them at the, you know, the site where you go skiing, or how many of you have car sharing where you live? Car sharing
Zip
companies?
Yes.
Yeah, what?
Zipcar.
Zipcar. You have Zipcar, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, we have Philly Car Share where I live, and they say they have kept, they can give you the stats how many cars they've kept off the road because they've made it so convenient that people will rent the car for just the time that they use it. A car sits idle much more of the time than it's used. Anybody know, someone calculated how much a vacuum cleaner is used over its lifetime. Anybody want to guess?
In terms of hours, you
say? Yeah, in hours, total time in its life.
10%.
10% of what?
Yeah.
10% of what? Give me hours, yeah, or days, or something.
290.
It's 2 weeks. 2 weeks.
2 weeks out of a year.
No, and it's total. If you ran it 24/7.
Oh, got it.
That's how much it would be used. I don't know, but it's kind of
before it's thrown away or before it dies.
Well, either or, yeah. So the point is that many products that us consumers use are not used very intensely. Okay, so that has means several things for the environment. First of all, people have to have homes big enough to store all this stuff that we use infrequently, and a lot of materials and energy goes into producing these things. And if you think about it from the producer's perspective, if you're in the business of selling vacuum cleaners, how do you make more money? How do you increase your profits, your revenues? Okay, you find ways to sell more vacuum cleaners, right? But if you're...
Vacuum cleaners more quickly than the same person.
Right. So if you put spiffy new... additions on it, features on it that will make people think their old vacuum cleaner is out of date, that's one way, or having it wear out fairly quickly is another way.
Right? They used to call that planned obsolescence.
Planned obsolescence, right, okay. But if you're leasing vacuum cleaners, let's say, or leaf blowers, what's your how do you make more money then?
That's true.
How would you use more?
Have it used as intensely as possible? Is that what you're saying? Yeah. Okay, but how would you design the vacuum cleaner that's going to be used that intensely?
Very well.
Yes. You'd make it good quality, sturdy, right?
Good quality.
Yes, okay. So you'd make it good quality, and since you're going to own it at the end of its life, what might you do about that? Well, what would you do with the design of it then to address that?
Make it so you could replace the squares.
Yeah. Right, you make the parts interchangeable, you make it repairable and recyclable and all that stuff that's good for the environment. Right, okay. So you can see it changes the whole incentive system. And so in Europe they call this consumption without ownership. And it's also being done in business suppliers to manufacturers in the business-to-business marketplace where, for example, there's a paint company that helped Chrysler, was selling paint, supplying paint to Chrysler, and they helped Chrysler use less paint. And you think about it, if you're selling buckets of paint, how do you make more money? Sell more buckets of paint, right. So but they changed the business model, and they began to get paid for how many units, how many cars they painted. So if that's the business, if that's the model, how do you make more money then? If you're getting paid,
sell fewer buckets.
Right. You want to paint as many cars as possible with as little paint as possible. All right. So this is Sandra Rothenberg at Rochester Institute of Technology has studied this and has many examples of where company suppliers have actually helped their customers use less of their own product. So,
excuse me,
yeah.
B2C up there.
That means business to consumer. That's business speak. Oh, and you remind me, one of the things I try to do, to me this is a intercultural event, because the business culture and environmentalist culture are really quite distinct. And my goal in any kind of educational event is to create a kind of bridging organizations where members of either culture can kind of explore more freely than they do when they're in their own home camp, the other culture. So please remind me if I use business speak or whatever that you don't understand. Okay, so that's ways in which companies are making that switch in their mental map to this condition of the second industrial revolution. Yeah.
Isn't that reference made Sandra Rothenberg?
Sandra Rothenberg, yeah.
Rochester Institute.
Of Technology. Her article was published in the Sloan Management Review. I can give you the reference afterwards if you like. Yeah. It's a classic. So the second shift I symbolize with the tree, because with the tree there is no waste, right? What happens when this time of year when the leaves die and fall off the tree, what happens to them?
Composted back into the earth.
Right, they become nutrition for the next season's growth, right? And that's the idea here, and this comes from some of the work of Bill McDonough, that all the output of industrial production be either biodegradable, so it can be put back into the ecosystem, or become nutrition or input to another industrial process. All right? And the most compelling example I have found, for years I collected learning diaries from students. So, and this example was always mentioned. So I know this was one of the most impactful examples. This is a company that Bill McDonough worked with. Rohner is a Swiss textile company, a small company. And they got into trouble because the trimmings from their looms was declared hazardous waste. And that meant that they had an extra expense of extra cost to dispose, to have the hazardous waste taken away. It also meant they could no longer use it. They liked to use the trimmings, they would burn the trimmings to heat the dye vats, and they could no longer do that if it was hazardous waste. So that meant they had to buy extra fuel for the dye vats. So it was an economic blow to them. So they began consulting with Bill McDonough, and they came up with the idea of, gee, I wonder if we could make our textiles without using the toxins were in the dyes that they were using. So they got the idea, maybe we could do it without the toxic materials. So they started calling up their suppliers, who were chemical companies, and saying, please send us a list of all the ingredients in the dyes that we buy from you. And can you guess what their response was?
You know what's in there.
No, they knew. They did. What?
They didn't want to tell.
Exactly, yes. They said, what we're doing is legal, and this is proprietary, and so please go away. But they persisted. And after, I think, 2 years, they finally got Siba Geigy, who was a fellow Swiss company, to reveal the ingredients. And once they did, the others followed. And so they wound up with a list of 1,600 different chemicals that were in the dyes. And they ran them through a protocol that McDonough's company owns, and they found that of the 1,600, 16 were completely non-toxic. So they did some research and found that they could make a full palette of colors that they needed with just those 16 ingredients. And that's what they did. And now the trimmings from their looms are sold as compost to gardeners. They've won design awards for their materials. And it's a story of how it can be done with less toxic things that we think couldn't be done without using toxic chemicals can be done without them. Another way that of eliminating so that's one way, one strategy is to eliminate the toxic inputs, okay? Then the output is more likely to be biodegradable, right? Another way to think about this is in terms of the value chain. Is that a familiar concept to anybody?
No.
Okay. This is, basic pablum in business schools, but I think it's also kind of in the popular culture, too. I mean, I think people have this. This is the image that's given in, textbooks of our production process, right? It's a linear thing, and it starts with at one end of taking materials from the earth, iron ore and sand and metals, and then transforming it in different stages till it becomes a product. At the other end is the product in the hands of the user, the person who's going to use it, the customer, right? And so what's wrong with this picture? This is, I think, sort of our culture's mental map of our production system. What's wrong with this picture?
The degree to which the resources are not self-perpetuating, the initial resources that they're not going to be there all the time.
Okay. It doesn't, yeah.
I have to say, what's wrong with this picture? I can't read it.
Oh, well, you don't have to worry about what's in the box. It's just going from, when I do this, we make our own chain when I have more time and we do this in a educational environment where I'll say, well, let's say we make the AK Rice refrigerator company, all right? And we'd make the middle box there be the manufacturing facility for the AK Rice refrigerators. And then we'd first go up, so-called upstream. We talk about, well, what supplies do we need to source in order to produce a refrigerator? And it would be plastic shelves and, glass shelves and wires and compressors. And then we'd say, well, what do the people who make those things need to source in order to make those things? And eventually we'd get to the earth. They'd be digging sand and iron ore out of the earth, all right? That's the upstream. And then we'd go downstream and we'd talk about, well, where does the refrigerator go once it leaves the AK Rice factory? And so it might go to Sears or Home Depot, and then a customer, right? So that's the idea. It doesn't...
I think I don't understand why it's called a value chain.
Ah, that's
like
a good question.
Value to whom? The real question, I've never seen, this is a systems analysis. It's an open systems analysis for me in terms of my training. There's never a word called value in it for me unless we add capitalism. But it's not a value chain from my point of view, or it begs the question of value for whom, right?
Okay.
There's a value to the supplier and a value to the consumer, but that leaves out a whole lot of territory.
Mm-hmm.
Value to us as a culture, value to us as a species that inhabits a planet. I mean, it's way too limited. And
right.
If
right.
people study this and they believe this is how everything should work.
Right. Right. Okay. So that's one thing. One thing wrong with the picture. Right.
Well,
okay.
Big thing wrong with it.
I guess the other thing for me is that it isn't complex enough. So I come from a country where 10 years ago, a whole small village of people were infected by groundwater from farm.
Mm-hmm.
And so the thought of industrial farming, of actually killing people who lived in the town, is not configured in And so it's a complex system to understand what the effects are.
Okay, so it leaves out some of those byproducts, some of which may be hazardous.
Yes.
Right, okay. What else?
This is great. I was thinking that maybe some of the evaluation takes place in the process. I don't know if this fits into the value chain, but a few years ago, the Psychological Association was targeted because some of its members were advising in terrorism. So it seems to me that the intention would be that the service gets the value by who uses it, but not by the person who delivers it. So that might be some part of the evaluation that takes place.
Okay, I'm not sure what you mean by the service.
Service.
But what, in this, what would it be here?
Given that model, if I were organic pharma and I had delivered my service to a manufacturing plant,
your products?
Right.
Yeah,
right.
Okay, products.
Okay, the tomatoes.
Yes.
To a manufacturing plant.
Right.
And they put all kinds of chemicals in it.
Yes.
I would think that my product was devalued.
Right.
Okay. When it gets to the consumer.
Mm-hmm.
So I see the evaluation in the value chain.
Yes, right. Whereas the assumption in the B school textbook is that value is added at each stage along the chain, right? Okay. Yes.
Missing the end product. What happens to it?
Say that
what
again.
What happens to the end product once it's been in the market for a while?
We eat the tomato.
Mean being in the market or being in the possession of the customer?
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Okay.
It's linear. It only goes to the end point, and it's sort of like I just looked at it. It should circle back around so that ultimately we market it, and then somebody buys it, and then we use it, and then it goes back.
It's not
sustainable. It just goes out that way.
Yeah. Well, what happens at the end of the life of the product? Right.
Goes to the landfill.
Yeah, it doesn't go away. There is no away, McDonough's, all right? So that's usually the first guess here. So then I introduce, here's a very different value chain, and you can see if you think this qualifies as a value chain. This is from the work of Gunther Pauli, who's a Belgian entrepreneur, who was the founder of the Ecover company. Anybody use Ecover products?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Dish detergents and laundry detergents that are biodegradable. This is what he's doing now. He's setting up industrial systems that have zero waste. And this is a simplified version of this system. This was a brewery in Namibia, and they found that the so-called waste from the brewery, some of it was a very good medium for growing mushrooms. So they started growing mushrooms and then had a mushroom business and food. And the rest of it was good for growing earthworms. So they started growing earthworms, and of course chickens like to eat earthworms. So they started having chickens, and chickens lay eggs, and so there's more food and more business. And then the waste from the chickens was put into a digester and converted to energy to power the brewery. Right? And as I said, this is a simplified version. There's also a fish pond and cows and other things in it. And when I did this with the executives in India, they somehow built in the city water system to it, and had the city water system going through this process. So this is a very different kind of value chain. Would you call this a value chain?
What happens to the glass and the caps and the equipment?
Ah, okay. I don't know.
There must be some other intersecting chains, because I was thinking they make beer from eggs and then a beer. So there must be some intersecting.
Oh, there's other inputs. Yeah, sure. Yeah.
One of the things I think we need to think about is what time frame we're talking about.
Uh-huh.
I was recently reading an article about geological time and about how there's no way that, that we humans can even think about that because it's so long.
Yeah.
So in one way, I think that when you throw a refrigerator in a landfill, eventually, in a billion years, it's not wasted, or it does return to the earth. So I think what we're talking about is how long, how quickly do we want to, you know, is it immediate recycle or is it a million year recycling?
Okay.
I think that's important to recognize.
Right.
So we're talking about now.
This comes way closer to your definition for sustainable development, for sure. Way closer.
How so?
Well, because it's hard to you know, you talked about it with economic development without degradation of the planet, and it doesn't appear that there's much degradation here at all. Maybe there is some, but it's not apparent, or it looks minor.
So you're maximizing the useful of the resources.
Well, it's the things we used to call waste are now byproducts that are reused. Yeah, they're used, put to another use, right. Yeah.
You know, sometimes, I think you started by agreeing that this is a good for all sorts of reasons. But sometimes when, at least where I live, when they're contemplating recycling or zero waste or any kind of sustainable conservation, whatever, what fails to get included in the equation and people are sort of like surprised or dismayed about later is the cost of doing all those things. Started a single stream recycling system, which is wonderful, except that they didn't have all the infrastructure ready to kind of deal with this stuff. So even though it's good, and even though I personally don't mind even somewhat of an increased cost to have that convenience plus conservation, whatever, it didn't get taken into account because they had to kind of transport all this stuff a lot further away than they will need to once they get a plant built, and then they're going to build a plant closer. And so, like all those hidden costs sometimes don't get into the equation. And
But you're in a, sounds like you're in a transition phase.
Yeah, but
and
they don't really get thought about. It's like, okay, we're going to have. I was thinking the vacuum cleaner. Well, okay, so like maybe the people on my street could share a vacuum cleaner.
Yeah.
You know, a couple houses could share a vacuum cleaner. Somebody would have that. Somebody else would have a leaf blower or whatever. That becomes a lot easier. But when you think about, you know, you live a little further away and it's heavy and you really can't take it and it's not something that somebody in the neighborhood would have, then you have to think about the costs and consumption involved in not having a vacuum cleaner, but you need to use one, so you have to go rent one.
Right, sure. It's more complicated. And this for sure is an agricultural example. But there are, this is, the thought precedes the design of these systems. And if you're thinking that linear thing, it's not going to happen. There are some examples from, you know, more industrial system. There's a whole new deconstruction industry in housing, buildings, where instead of taking everything to the landfill, the stuff is, it's more labor intensive. It uses more, employs more people because you have to take nails out of boards and things like that. But they are then, can then be resold and reused, and they're, it's a good value for the people who buy the used stuff. It employs people and it's got many benefits. So it is, if you're thinking this way, you can, you, other opportunities to come up. But this is for sure a limited example. And Pauli himself says that, and I'm not sure what the reasons are, but this can't be scaled up. This is kind of a small scale project. But he does have these going on all over the world. He trains people to do these, and one of my students who got all fired up discovered that he had a project in Montana, and he was considering going out there to join in. Okay, so we've seen two strategies for kind of getting, eliminating the concept of waste. One is to have non-toxic ingredients going into products, And the other is to think in terms of these loopy value chains where the output is not just the specific product, but the byproducts are also put to good use. Here's the other example of eliminating toxins. Any of you heard of biomimicry? Yes? Janine Benyus wrote the book, Biomimicry, in 1997 it was published. And it got almost no attention until recent years, where it's getting a lot of attention. And it's an exciting concept. The idea here is that many of the things that we do with chemicals and industrial treatment, you know, heating things and putting pressure on them and all those things, nature does without heat, feed, and treat, as she puts it. Okay. So her idea is that we should be examining how nature does this. We should be investigating how does an oyster make a shell that's harder than any ceramic that man has made, that humans have made. The spider web is 5 times stronger than steel. And yet they make it in a way where it doesn't spoil. It's made locally, so, and it has to degrade locally. Okay, they can't send it away when they're done with the shell or the spider web. It has to be something that's biodegradable. Okay, and so she's gotten a lot of engineers, industrial engineers, and a lot of corporate people fired up about this, and she takes them out in outings out into the woods, and they find plants and animals that are solving some of the same problems they're trying to solve back in the lab, but doing it without toxins or heat, feed, and treat, as she puts it. So this example is the lotus leaf, which looks smooth, but on closer investigation has these little whatever they call them, little spheres, and that's makes it a self-cleaning system. So they're adding little spheres to paints and coatings on buildings and stuff so that they will be self-cleaning and not require the use of chemicals to clean them. Fabrics is another use, right? And there are many examples. Just go to the biomimicry website and you'll be overwhelmed. Okay, so that's the second shift, is from thinking that we make products and then we ship the waste away to realizing there is no away, and we have to have strategies for using all the byproducts, right? So the third shift has to do, I symbolize, with the pyramid. And the story here is that until recently, almost all products and services were designed for the wealthiest 1 billion people in the world, at the top of the economic pyramid. And now, of course, we have the emerging economies. We have China and India and others. And it only takes common sense to realize that if they develop with the same size environmental footprint that we did, that it would take several planets to provide the resources and absorb the waste. So the challenge here is to develop a greener path, find a greener path to development for these emerging economies and for ourselves. So, for example, my power company executives were very mindful of all the coal-fired plants in their neighbor China and how massive the pollution was from that, and they were very proud to be building some of them hydro plants, which are cleaner. And so the challenge here, this is not necessarily going low tech, you know, back to the future like our broom ladies example, but of finding technologies that are simpler, cleaner, cheaper, and greener. Okay. And this is one that I use to illustrate an example of what a radical innovation is. Anybody use these? What?
Is that one of those dryer things?
No, it doesn't go in the dryer. It goes in the other appliance.
The washer.
The washer, right. It's got little ceramic stones inside, and they interact with the water and change the molecular structure so that it gets into the fabric, lifts out the dirt without detergent, which is does the same thing detergent does without detergent.
How long does that last?
700 loads.
That's good. How much does it cost?
Well, I use it in a set of three, and it costs $50.
And it works?
Yeah.
Do you have to heat the water then?
I think it does work a little better in warm water than cold water. Mm-hmm. Sure.
Take stains out too?
Well, you can add a little papaya enzyme if you want. But why is this a radical innovation? Think about it.
How can you get clean
without soap? The thought is radical?
And the thought is radical, yeah.
Okay. Why else?
Cute.
Is what?
Cute.
The waste is reduced substantially when you're not buying the soap and throwing away the soapy water and, you know,
Right. You can put the water on your garden or something because it's not, it doesn't have detergent in it. Yeah. Did you have something else to say?
No.
Okay. Well, now think about it from the perspective of Procter & Gamble. Why would this be a radical innovation to them?
The
what?
They're already doing.
It challenges their profit model.
Maybe they're doing this. I don't know who's making this.
That's a good question. This one is made by a Japanese company. But yeah, if you think about what they would, if this became the standard technology for doing laundry, what would they have to change in their business in order to switch?
Billions of things.
Everything, just about, yeah. Right.
You know, there's some theory out there that companies have to be ambidextrous, meaning that they've got to develop these new technologies at the same time they're keeping their current technology in place until their business model will help them move here. So the concept of ambidexterity in terms of corporate product making is, I think, very helpful to the sustainability movement. It's not like you stop this one day and start the new thing. You
exactly. Yes. I did once have a student who's told me that Clorox was working on this technology, but we'll see.
So I think we want to know where to buy
it.
It's here. It is. It's called a laundry disc. If you want a set, you go to realgoods.com. Actually, I like soap nuts better, but I don't know if we want to get into that. Soap nuts grow on trees in China, and they have some substance on the outside of them. You put them in a little cloth bag and throw them in the washer, and I think they work better. But I've been following these for about 15 years. They at one point were listed in the SkyMall catalogs in airplanes, but that was just for a couple of years there.
I can imagine I can imagine there being a lot of covert pushback, corporate pushback against it.
I don't know. Yeah. I don't know. It's a privately owned company, and I wasn't able to get any, sales information from them.
We'll see if the guy who runs Z-Cover takes this on, with some of his products. Well, what for me is interesting is that you had to go to the East to find these products.
Yes, of course.
What has been lost in American culture that these kinds of products doesn't exist?
Well, that's an excellent point. There is a whole school of thought now about how the emerging economies, we think of it as places where we transfer our technology there, but it's going the other way just as much now. And in fact, it's seen as a great incubator for these products that are cheaper, simpler, and more environmentally friendly. Hewlett-Packard is working on improving the energy efficiency of data centers. And they have a project in India the economics work there because there isn't a reliable central grid, electric grid. whereas in the U.S. they couldn't make the numbers come out right. So it's become a kind of an incubator for new technologies. Yeah. And look for more of that to come. Okay, so that's the third shift. And as I read my learning diaries, these are the aha moments where there are descriptions of this making this shift in the mindset. And one is when we do this, we do a simulation about the fisheries, in the New England fisheries, and they're in teams that are each team is a fishing company, and the competition gets going. And even though they know they're overfishing and the fish population is going to crash, they can't stop it. Okay, so they come to understand the tragedy of the commons, which is not the tragedy is not the loss of the fish, but the remorseless working of things. You know, the inability to stop this before it's too late. And we also talk about the Earth's atmosphere, for example, as a kind of commons. They entertain the idea that with the economic pyramid, it's not just a matter of raising up the people at the bottom, but it's also a matter of the people at the top consuming less, reducing consumption. Some of that can be painless through consumption without ownership, but some of it might involve actually using less stuff. The point that the value chain is not linear is one that always hits home, and the idea that we are I think of it as developing global citizenship, the idea that there is no way that we can't clean up our environment. Well, we can clean up our environment by shipping the polluting facilities and the trash to the other side of the world, but it doesn't work sustainably. Let me go to this slide first. So here's this is actually a video that I use about electronic waste, which goes where? Anybody know?
China.
Yes. A lot of it. China, Africa, India, where it's dismantled under conditions with no protective gear for the people who do it, and it just ruins the environment. So the two ways in which I have tried to apply group relations theory, and I certainly want to hear your thoughts. One was in this paper I did with Dana Kamenstein, which we called The Loss of the Natural Environment. And we talked about how difficult the emotions are if you really contemplate the full loss of the environment. The emotions that would come up would be things like anger, sadness, fear, helplessness, and guilt. Wait a minute. And so what does group relations theory suggest that we do with ourselves when unpleasant emotions like that are brought up?
We raise defenses.
Yeah. And in this case, what might those be?
Avoidance, denial.
Right. Right. So it's there's sending the stuff away becomes an important defense. We don't have to protect us from dealing with these emotions.
Yeah. So, like proxy.
Say that.
Send the stuff away. Please, flee the bad stuff over to somebody.
Right.
This is sort of like projection of our waste onto other countries.
Mm.
Yeah.
Of our physical waste,
as well as our
as well as our toxic emotions. Yeah.
Well, and I think sort of understand taking the stance that the the businesses and industry and et cetera, are the ones who are doing this, and that we don't have a part in it.
Mm.
So projecting onto EP or whoever.
Mm-hmm. There is a treaty, the Basel Convention, that would prohibits countries from sending hazardous waste outside their boundaries. I believe it's in force in Europe, but of course the U.S. has not taken it up, not signed on. So that leads to the. Another thing I've done, I've thought of this is trying to develop global citizenship in people. And one of the things I did in that regard was I hooked up some management students in India with a discussion board that my students at University of Pennsylvania were doing. So they participated in the discussion board. And one of the Indian students made this comment on a week when they were discussing consumption. He said, "I have a completely different perspective to the entire issue. Charles Darwin has rightly said, as many more individuals of each species are born than can possibly survive, and consequently there is a frequently recurring struggle for existence. I feel this is what is happening to mankind now. And at last, only the fittest survive. There should be a day when the journey of Homo sapiens has to end and a new species, Homo XX, has to evolve. I feel that's what is happening now. Environmental disasters are beginning to occur to instill the process of evolution. I feel the species would itself adapt to the changing environmental circumstances by appropriate adaptation. We members of species Homo sapiens cannot sail against the wind being the process of evolution. We have to accept it as a natural process. The best thing we can to deter the process for some time could be technology, but that cannot act as a savior. At last, nature should win, and mankind has to end. Sorry for being skeptical and moving a little tangential from the entire issue. I just wanted to put this thought across."
Not exactly tangential.
No. No, but a little shocking to the Penn students. And so what are your, tell me more about your thoughts about how group relations might inform or work with this issue. And one of the things is that too much doom and gloom, we're at a doom and gloom moment here, is not motivating.
These students don't have a sense, I think, that, well, this of course could be just hubris, but that the species has the potential for consciousness of its collective behavior.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know enough about other species to know whether they do as well.
Right.
But I think that's what's missing here,
yeah,
is any sort of faith that our species has the capacity to use that consciousness,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
in behalf of the broader surround, not just our species.
Right.
So I think, I don't feel this is gloomy. I think it's fascinating.
Okay.
I think, group relations tries to bring into bold relief what our unspoken or unconscious, mm-hmm, assumptions are, so, mm-hmm, that they can be questioned may be changed, at least in terms of behavior. I mean, I find it really annoying to try to live my whole life with the consciousness of how I'm using resources. Sometimes I hate it.
Yeah.
The arduousness of paying attention to everything.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, it's a must.
Yeah, we are. What's the choice? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're defining a task, the T in group relations.
Yeah, and, okay.
Group relations is uniquely, well, not only group relations, but group relations. We do look at the unconscious processes that are going on, looking towards the task or looking against the task.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is really important that the task is stated and the consciousnesses are being stated. They're necessary by thinking of ourselves as a global community.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're in dialogue now in the service of the task, and I think that's necessary.
Yeah.
And going to be more and more effective generation after generation. We grew up pretty spoiled, but the next generation is taking this conversation seriously.
That's true.
Well, I think the whole kind of systems understanding of things is that, you know, any individual thing is in a context. It's in a social context, and, you know, it's in an environmental context. Unlike to a large extent, other species, I guess I'm thinking of beavers, they kind of change the environment, but... but we not only... Some of our adaptability actually changes the environment in a much different way than I think most other species have or do. I mean, I don't know that the dinosaurs did too much to change the climate.
Can you talk more about it?
I said I don't know that the dinosaurs did too much to change the climate. We may be doing things to change the climate that may be adding to, you know, what may be normal processes of change. And so we're not just having to respond and adapt. We're having to look at the ways in which we may be causative factors.
Right.
In some of these changes.
Well, we're the
designers. We then have to adapt to.
We're the designers of these systems, right?
Well, I'm thinking about if our primary task of this group, humanity, is to survive, then maybe we sometimes even lose the primary task.
Yeah.
Which is like really scary.
That's pretty basic, yeah.
Because for me, it is actually because of survival that this is going on. And the question is, how will we survive? And this is about surviving in a way that is quite luxurious. And that is what's being worked towards. And that is what I think is not being taken responsibility for. In your example of the Indian women and the leaf blower, the leaf blower is a luxurious thing not to use your body, and that is what seems to be the goal of the West to some extent, while you know, we actually have bodies to use, and we're not going that route, and therefore this is happening. So it's about how we take up our task of surviving that I think is a problem.
I want to add to that. I think that's what you're saying is very important, is this idea that technology is separating our mind from our body. And in many ways, it's a parallel process of kind of what's going on in the world, what's going on Earth. We're trying to just be spiritual and intellectual. It's being physical, and the physical body is it's an example of the planet Earth, and it is connected to planet Earth. And what connects us and grounds us to this Earth.
Right.
And when we, you know, it's a parallel process, we don't appreciate our own bodies. And, you know, we don't take care of our own bodies, and therefore we don't take care of the Earth. It's the same.
Right. And some of the very basic things like water are at risk.
Yeah.
Well, I don't think what you're saying is right on, but it's kind of like the history of the mind-body split in Western culture is all about this. You know, there mm-hmm. are other cultures that are much more integrated than mm-hmm. Westerners mm-hmm. with regard to the mind and the body. It's like in literature everywhere, in Western culture, is the separation of these things. I think it's right, everything you're saying. Why would we transfer our materiality into machines? Why would we do that? Except that we believe it's okay. It's fascinating.
Well, can you envision or brainstorm any ideas about what a group relations oriented educational event would look like on this, you know, on these issues?
Well, I don't know, but what you've enthused me about doing is going back to Portland and offering some of the environmentalists that I know mm-hmm. to facilitate a support group for them using mm-hmm. relations. Mm-hmm. Because I know they're the most earnest people mm-hmm. in the world, mm-hmm. but they get really discouraged even yeah. in a community like ours, which is relatively right. hip around right. environmental questions. Right. And I know they need some way of thinking about the exhaustion and the discouragement and the... Mm-hmm. So it'd be easy to do, mm-hmm. you know, to just work in your own community mm-hmm. around bringing what you might offer to assist.
Yeah.
It seems like, you know, one of the big things about group relations is that, you know, in terms of environmentalists... Mm-hmm. If the environmental groups get used so much mm-hmm. for other purposes, it's very hard to stay on task.
What other purposes?
Oh, you name the environmental movement and there's some sort of pernicious thing going on underneath. You know, I can't think of an example just off the top of my head, but I know every time I hear a Greenpeace movement, I know that there's some for-profit group behind the scenes who's very interested in this happening for their own profit and for their own destruction of the earth, you know, or for their own kind of self-interest. So so using environmentalism to look like you're doing something good, but mm-hmm. really you're doing something bad, is a common thing.
Well, there's a whole controversy about business and environmental NGOs teaming up and working together. And I've heard your fairly skeptical views, but I guess what the World Wildlife Fund says, and they're big time allied with corporations. What they say, what they have done is they've identified hot spots around the globe where ecosystems are endangered. Or wildlife, and then they look at what products, what supply chains are impacting those ecosystems, like palm oil production, and then they take it the next step and look at what companies are using those supplies in their products. Who are the major users of those supplies, and then they target They are the initiator of the alliance with those companies, and they try to work with them. So I don't know whether you buy that, but it is their strategy. Yeah.
I was wondering about ACRI.
Yeah.
As a system.
Yes.
And being part of this bigger system, and I'm thinking back now. We sort of have our value chain when we look at it.
Uh-huh.
And look at the reader, you import, you process, you export at a conference.
Right.
And I'm sort of wondering, what are our waste products?
Yeah.
And
I like that.
How do we use them or don't use them? Or do we really have a circle or do we have just our own value chain?
Yeah.
I don't know. But I was curious about how people might see what is our waste?
Mm-hmm.
And where does it go? What mm-hmm. do we do with it?
Mm-hmm.
Right,
we do have a circulating system, I think, because people get interested and they come back and they bring others. But there is also what return waste, I think, which is people who get hurt in conference work, or people who get discouraged because their aspirations aren't met, or we fight with each other, or, you know, there are enormous ways in which we waste the potential we have, right? But I do think, you know, in the sense that resources recirculate in our system.
Well, I was thinking that, I was just wondering, like, we're bound to have some waste, though.
You mean like paper?
Are you talking about physical waste? Like,
I don't know what I'm talking about.
Okay.
Maybe physical waste. I'm thinking like, that, well, here we all have, you know, have a giant carbon footprint to come here to this meeting.
For sure.
I'm just worried about that.
Well, so the question is, what are resources that waste?
Useful.
There's a whole, a lot of conference planners look for green venues when selecting places. I don't know if that happens in Akron.
Well, it's interesting. One could kind of think about the whole online group relations conference, or the whole online thing, as a way to much more low impactively engage this work in a broader way. So that's interesting.
There were several references to planning committees at various levels of this conference that were conducted their business entirely in cyberspace,
right,
as opposed to coming together physically. So that's a step in the right direction.
And it happens at board meetings too. I mean, it happens face to face some, but a lot of it was phone.
I'm also thinking along the lines of how these group relations conferences have helped me to see how things aren't personal so much. And like so much of it is just various subgroups and the tensions between different kind of priorities or values that are being held and that are inevitably going to be distributed throughout a system, and how that might be useful for the various stakeholders in trying to implement this transformation in how we use resources, and how do you illuminate that framework, and so it's not so personal and it's not fights of the death between the competing subgroups.
Right.
That's an interesting question. Yeah. I just have an association because I was talking about this. One of the wastes that we, and maybe I'm digressing, but one of the wastes in our work is the competition, you know, fighting, etc. But competition is inevitable, and sometimes it's productive competition where you kind of spur each other on to do better, and then there's unproductive competition. So I was thinking that that's a kind of a waste, conceptual type of waste, where it's just wasting energy fighting each other, putting each other down without spurring the other kind of productive.
Okay.
I'm thinking about what you said, Charlotte, and I was thinking about Barbara and Deborah's presentation yesterday about how insular Acre can be, or have been under walls or something.
Right.
So maybe the fact that we're in our own feedback loop and don't get out enough might be viewed as one kind of waste. I mean, we're just recycling ourselves.
Right.
To what end?
I agree. That's why a presentation like yours is such a breath of fresh air to actually bring the question about what can group relations contribute to something really so relevant and built around. So, again, I think that's the way out of most of this. But I also agree with you and you that competition is inevitable. What happens in our city is that a big conglomerate called Waste Management almost all the city's waste out to landfills or puts them on barges and floats them out the Columbia River to go to Asia, right? So that's the business. But there are lots of small recyclers in Portland that are wonderful, and they'll take a lot more products than Waste Management will. But Waste Management, of course, wants them to die. and they're trying to copy some of their methods to put them out of business, and then the small recyclers themselves are competing with each other. They haven't figured out how to share the territory, like one would specialize in this. So it's I think competition is part of the species, and the question is how do we is there a way to use it creatively in this process?
Well, that sounds like part of, just a new industry. What happens in a new industry? There's a, once the opportunity space becomes apparent, people jump in.
Right.
And then there's a sorting out.
Yeah,
you know.
Exactly. Maybe that's the kind of social Darwinism that's tolerable, as long as it's in the direction of a good cause.
Mm-hmm.
But still, I mean, for these small recyclers that lose their livelihood, it's a tough road to go.
Right.
And that touches on the issue of authority, too. It's like, it's, as long as it's in the service of a good cause, well, on who's, where's the authority to establish that?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Well, the task is, Shelley was talking about, the task is inhabiting the planet in a way that doesn't degrade it in this case. And so if everybody's pursuing that, like these small recyclers, I often think, why don't you guys get together and talk about specializing? And that way you can all work and do what you believe in. And some of them do, but not all of them.
Well, I want to get to her question, but where I live, you're in a different culture there. Where I live, I met a recycler who's doing electronic waste in a responsible way. He has welcomed workers who have protective gear and do it right. But he does not mention the environment in his selling of his service. He sells it strictly on the basis of data security.
Mm-hmm.
He guarantees he will smash your hard drive to smithereens so that no one can steal any data off of it. And that's, he doesn't mention the environment.
We have 10 minutes.
Okay. Let's get her.
Well, my vision is that there's an online group relations weekend. Online, so it's using, energy efficient. And then I don't know about all of what would happen, but one thing that would happen would be an IE, where people would break into subgroups, and the people who wanted to talk to the media and be articulate, for consciousness raising would be in one subgroup, and another subgroup would be able to do, making up lists of how to be able to actually get out there and have impact. And so all the people versed in this topic could be in conversation on the topic, and then actually for my e-groups that would, and then they met once, four times a year or something, and came back, then they could have accountability to report back on what happened. Maybe that would be the large group, that we would be reporting back what happened. The plenary would be an opening like what you've just given.
Okay.
Where the plenary introduces the topic that is the work, the focus of the work of the weekend. So I have the plenary and the IE, I just don't have clarity about how the large group and small groups would work.
It is a similar model like that at Morgan State University, using open space
as the
work. But we were using it for institutional transformation, so it wasn't so much like export. The application was for the institution, right? So so work on those particular interest areas. But I wanted to talk about, Charlie, you talk about Oregon, because, you probably know Arnie Mandel and the work, with World Work that is done there. And I was wondering if maybe if that's an avenue for ACRI to and World Work to have a joint conference, because
that is an interesting idea, and then to join it with Shelley's idea, we could. I don't know about conferences. I tried to do one on healthcare in 1991. There was enormous learning, but did any reform come out of it? I doubt it. So it's like, what is the conference model applicable to? It's applicable to raising consciousness, and you can design it in a way that will do that about many issues. But then it's the application work that really matters.
Right.
And we could, to address Michael's point too, is that we could ask ACRI members what they're most interested in. You know, for example, this one is about the environment. My special interest is healthcare reform. You know, there are undoubtedly people who want to work on education. And we could create, you know, application groups out of ACRI where people wanted to commit some time and the use of their understanding out of ACRI to move out into the world in some sense to the level that people have time and energy to invest in it. And figure out, do we do conferences to start with, or do we simply try to work using what we know in systems where these things are resisted? You know, trying to deal with the resistance or trying to help the movement without paying attention to the resistance, because most change theorists talk about getting rid of the resistance. I'm not so sure that's the deal, as it is trying to lead with the forces that are proactively in favor of the changes that are needed. Right. So, but I think it's a really fascinating idea that we could figure out if we want to create special focus groups and then move with those, with what we understand about systems. I think it's a great fascinating idea. Who's on the board here?
I am.
I'm glad that
3 minutes is very, because what World Work does, they actually have a World Work conference. They have the membership actually comes from different parts of the world. It's, you know, what we have is international conference for staff, and we lack in the membership. But I think it's I think the draw is around social activism. They're able to bring people from all over the world, wherever these conferences are, and they have 200 people, 150.
Wow!
Right, just easy like that, you know, and it's a lot of energy. And I think there's a lot of application to this. You know, we've had some work done as we're working in DC that went into the communities and started doing some work.
Are these ideas going to be carried into the plenary that's coming up next? Not lost, I hope.
I don't think they'll be lost. The way we do these plenaries is often a little odd.
We'll see.
Okay. But just a plenary discussion. This discussion sounds different to me than the kind we've had in the past, because I just got some real clarity, because there's always been in our organization a difficulty with the people that want ACRI to become a social activism organization. Take position, ACRI as ACRI, taking positions on things, doing this, doing that, anyway. That's right. And then there are some people, I would put myself among them, that is definitely not what we want ACRI to be. We want ACRI to be the resource, a learning environment where people can come and learn about this stuff, and then us as people, so informed by this, can then go and do wherever we do it, stuff that is informed by this information.
There's a fable in the organization that the CIA once approached ACRI. This would have been in the 80s. The CIA approached ACRI and asked for consultation to some of the things they were doing and they were interested in, and ACRI said no, because the people in the leadership at that juncture didn't want to have our name associated with an organization like the CIA. And later on, some of us found out about it, and we said, why? You know, should we judge them or should we help them? You know, I mean, what do you decide about affiliating because you've decided some other system is corrupt? I mean, this was a, from my point of view and several others, a stupid idea that we wouldn't affiliate because they were impure. Do you know?
Well, it's like the corporate environmental group and alliances. Too, which are controversial, as I said.
Yes, exactly. But do you not try? I mean, that's the...
Right.
So it's just a weird... But I'm with Nancy, too, in a certain sense. We need to keep what we know sort of held somehow and let these other things blossom and in the world. Yeah.
Did you want to say something?
My association is... Well, the regime came to us
you know, would we, I mean, is there any place, Charlotte, where we would say, think not, you know?
Well, we would at least have given him a piece of advice.
I need a little picture.
That's right.
Is that where Eric Miller said he would consult with him?
Yes, he did. But I mean, I think though, to contrast that, if you were asked to consult to, let's say, someone who's an evil dictator or whatever, like,
maybe or just say Philip Morris.
Philip Morris. You know, there's, or Monsanto.
There we go.
There's an opportunity there to influence if you're consulting to them. You're given this great opportunity to influence and perhaps make a positive change. Mm-hmm. Whereas if we say, no, we're going to abstain, all you do is keep them doing the same bad stuff that they're doing.
Well, I think it depends on our role. If we're going to be a consultant, yes, there may be an opening to be able to have them think about some things they haven't thought about. Probably not, but maybe. If we're in the role of lackey, if you will, if we're in the role of, help us in a technical way to do better what we're already doing, then we'd like to talk.
But that's not, yeah, I mean,
second one is not an option for me. Yeah. That's the first one.
But I don't think we would go to any organization to help in a technical way.
But we have a technology. Yes.
Yeah.
You know, it becomes a who is willing to do what. That's kind of like, some organizations don't think people should be allowed to be members if they work with certain things or engage in certain things.
We're out of time, though.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for your participation. Yeah.
Who comes to your executive education seminars? Like, would some people like us, who this is not our primary field, or would you take sustainability staff people from smaller companies? When it says executive ed, it sounds like only the top people.
No, actually, a lot of my work is university based. So I work with MBA students at Rutgers, and I work. I do, sure. And I work with Masters of Environmental Studies students at University of Pennsylvania. So I work both sides of the business environmental divide. Yeah.
Thank you. I don't know.
You're welcome.